Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Fruit flies are simply annoying to most of us. To researchers that study the internal clock of humans and other animals, fruit flies hold the key to better understanding that clock. This week, the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine was awarded to three Americans for their work studying fruit flies on the circadian rhythm. Patrick Emery works with fruit flies to study circadian rhythms and was a trainee of one of the Nobel laureate recipients, Michael Rosbach of Brandeis University. Patrick is a professor of neurobiology at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, and he joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So give us the primer real quick. What are circadian rhythms?
So basically, circadian rhythms are the way organisms are responding to a major challenge in their life. So basically, the Earth is rotating on its axis. This is causing a cycle of day and night that comes with dramatic change in the environment, for example, light intensity. Changes very abruptly or with very high light intensity during the day and very low light intensities during the night. And you have also temperature, for example, that changes with higher temperature during the day usually and lower temperature during the night. So most organisms on Earth have to cope with these changes and importantly to be able to anticipate them to be as fit as possible to maximize their chances in the wild. So the solution to this this challenge is the use of what we call circadian clocks, which are real pacemakers that are inside our body and that allow the body to adapt to the changes that happen in the environment. And basically, they affect most bodily function, from very basic cellular metabolism to our physiology and, of course, to our behavior. And maybe what we think first when we think about circadian rhythm is our sleep-wake cycle, which is one of the major behavior that is being regulated by the circadian clock.
I was surprised to read when I was preparing for this, and I've done other shows on circadian rhythm before. It's not the first time, but I was surprised to read that scientists have been studying this since the 16th century, 17th century?
That's correct. The very first report of a circadian rhythm in the scientific literature dates from 1729. It was published in the Royal Proceedings of the Royal Society in Paris. And it was actually observing the movement, the opening and the closing of leaves in the mimosa plant.
Right. Were they even opened in the dark at morning time, even though they were not exposed to the sun?
That's exactly right. And a fascinating aspect of that little report is that the writer who is reporting the work from Jean-Jacques Dortout de Meyran, a French astronomer, on this mimosa plant, suggests that maybe there is a connection between what is seen in plants and what is seen in humans when patients, for example, people that are sick, bedridden, still knows when there is light outside and when they should be going to sleep.
I wish my circadian clock was a little weaker, frankly. I wish I could sleep in. That's what it's all about. Some people can sleep in, some people can't. But what's the connection between circadian rhythm and disease?
Circadian rhythm and disease. So that's a very, very interesting question. And so because circadian rhythms are basically affecting all our body clock, all our body function. So from, as I said, from cellular metabolism to our behavior, mm-hmm. if we start to, if we have a dissynchrony between our environment and our body clock inside, then we are trying to fight against our body clock. For example, shift workers have to be active when their body clock is telling them to be asleep. So that just cannot be very good in general for overall health. And there is strong indications that, for example, in shift workers, you have an increase in certain diseases. For example, cardiovascular diseases are more frequent, metabolic diseases are more frequent, as well as depression. So because they have to fight against their internal clock that tell them to do certain things, mm-hmm. is probably there is evidence, growing evidence, that this has some deleterious effects on health.
I would imagine that over the years, when it comes to shift work, third shift work and that kind of a thing, there are other correlations or correlatives that that are confused with circadian rhythm, but then now they're saying that they think it really goes back to that. It's not other kind of lifestyle issues.
Well, I would agree with you that this is a little bit of a complication. Mm-hmm. There could be other issues there, but it seems reasonably natural to me to think that if you fight against your body clock and what your physiology is telling you to do, this could have some effect on health. There is interesting experiments that were done in mice, for example, where you force the mice to be constantly in a jet lag situation. You keep shifting basically their light-dark cycle, and they die faster, particularly if they are older.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about circadian rhythm. Three American scientists were recently awarded the Nobel Prize in Medicine for their work with the fruit fly in studying circadian rhythm. My guest is Patrick Emery. He's a professor of neurobiology at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. You trained under one of the Nobel laureate recipients, Michael Rosbach, at Brandeis University.
That's correct.
What did you study with him?
So what I was interested when I was in his lab is to figure out how light would reach the circadian pacemaker that Michael Rosbach, in collaboration with Jeff Hall, as well as Michael Young at Rockefeller, had discovered. So how is light reaching the clock? And we used a fruit fly for this. And what we found that was really interesting is that we found that in fruit flies, there is a photoreceptor called cryptochrome. We detect blue light, and it's expressed even inside the brain of the fly where the circadian clocks are located and can provide very direct information of light to the clock. So that was my project. So I was one of the discoverers of cryptochrome in collaboration with Ralph Stanisky, who was a postdoc with Jeff Hall, also at Brandeis.
How was it discovered that fruit flies were good at this kind of research?
So that was, you have to go back to the late 60s. That was really a brilliant idea from Ron Konopka and Seymour Benzer. So Seymour Benzer was a very brilliant researcher who had that vision that fruit flies could be a fantastic model because of their powerful genetics to study complex behaviors. And Ron Konopka had that idea that since fruit fly had these very beautiful rhythms in behavior, we could combine these readouts for circadian rhythms with the genetics of fruit flies to try to figure out, to tease out how the circadian system work, and to isolate single gene mutants that would affect just one gene and then try to figure out what that gene does. So that was really the brilliant idea of these two researchers. And later on, when molecular tools were available to study, to actually isolate the PER gene and try to study its function, that's when the work of Jeff Hall, Mike Young, and Michael Rosbach came in. They cloned this gene and figured out how it works.
So, all right, so the circadian rhythm research has brought about chronotherapy in medicine. That's the idea of timed treatments where you're exposed to bright lights at early times of the day. Is it all about light and when you're exposed to it?
Can you repeat that question,
please? Chronotherapy?
Yes.
Tell us what is that?
Okay, so in this, there is some people, for example, people that suffer of seasonal affective disorders. Mm-hmm. It is thought that they might have a little bit of a hard time synchronizing their clock to the environment, particularly during the winter when there is less light, mm-hmm. than during the summer. So by exposing them to bright light, it is thought that this is helping to better synchronize their clock to the light-dark cycle and therefore help with their depression.
Has there been any hard evidence to suggest that's the way it is, or is it just thought of to help?
I'm not a specialist here, mm-hmm. but I believe that it was shown that there was an improvement in the face of certain markers for circadian rhythms that showed that if you do that light therapy, mm-hmm. you have a better phasing of these markers, if I remember correctly.
So from here, what's next? What's the future of circadian research and fruit flies?
In fruit flies, well, there is still a lot of questions that we have to answer. There is many level of regulation of the clock that we still do not understand. We have a reasonably good idea of how it works, but there is still a lot of elements, of regulatory elements that we have to understand. Also, there is a very interesting and fascinating basic question that we do not know yet. So for circadian clocks, and this is true for all organisms on Earth, circadian clocks have a very interesting property. So if it is hot or if it is cold, they still run at a 24-hour period. But they are based on a biochemical oscillator. And biochemical reactions are sensitive to temperature. So what are the mechanisms that keep the clock running at 24-hour pace? That we don't know. And that's something that we could really definitely look at in fruit flies. There are actually mutants in fruit flies that show defective mechanisms of temperature compensation. So that's an interesting area to explore.
Are there any practical applications? I know this isn't necessarily your specialty, but, you know, someone said to me, recently when we were talking about when you're in a hospital and they keep waking you up all night long. Are there any implications for that?
In terms of, well, I think we can make some prediction as to what could help in order to be more efficient, for example, at work or for students to be more efficient at school. For example, there is a very an interest right now in some school district to adjust the time at which school starts. So teenagers tend to have a circadian phase that is later than younger kids. Yet usually they go to school earlier.
Right.
So they tend to be sleep deprived. So this recognition that circadian clocks affect our cognitive ability. And our sleep, quality of sleep affect our cognitive ability is now being considered in terms of when kids should go to school. And that's one example.
Professor Patrick Emery, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you very much.
Patrick Henry is a professor of neurobiology at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Food allergies can be a nuisance and they can be deadly. Navigating life with food allergies can be difficult for anyone, especially for parents of children. Joining us now by phone is pediatric allergist at Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City, Dr. Scott Schischerer. His book, Food Allergies, A Complete Guide to Eating When Your Life Depends on It, is now out in its second edition. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
What causes food allergies?
Well, the complicated answer would be that it's an immune system response. It's, you know, the part of our body that's supposed to protect us from things like infection or developing tumors and such gets, you know, sort of misdirected and ends up attacking proteins that are in our foods that are otherwise harmless. And in that process, we end up getting sick.
Are there more allergies today than in the past?
We really believe there are. It's a very common question. Maybe we're noticing it more or something like that. But actually, I did studies in 1997 looking, for example, at the rate of peanut allergy across the United States in children, and we came up with a number of 1 in 250. Now, we repeated that study over an 11-year period, and in 2008, the number had already gone to 1 in 70, which I couldn't even believe that it had tripled, but it kind of matched numbers that people were coming up with who hadn't been, you know, repeating their studies over years. So it really does seem to be an increase. And, you know, some people say, well, you know, maybe you're just diagnosing it more, but for most of us who are, you know, on the older side of things, when we were kids in school, you know, it would have been pretty obvious if your friend was eating something and having an allergic reaction and it wasn't happening. You know, they weren't, you know, saying, oh, no, peanuts and tree nuts in schools in those days. And now, you know, many of us have children who are in schools, and they're, you know, they're just joining the group of multiple kids who have food allergies. So I think it's fairly obvious that there's been a change.
Is there any way to understand whether it's something in our culture or something in the environment, our behavior?
Yeah, it's clearly environmental, because although we've done studies looking at the genetic aspect of it, and there definitely is, so allergies and food allergies definitely run in families. It's also the case that to explain an increase, there has to be something in the environment. And one of the, you know, major, there are multiple hypotheses, but one of the major ones is the so-called hygiene or cleanliness hypothesis. Our lifestyles changed in so many ways, but one of the ways is that we're living, you know, cleaner. And again, this has to do with the immune system. We are well vaccinated, which is a good thing, but it also means that we're not fighting a lot of terrible infections. It means that we clean our hands. We're not living on farms. We have smaller families. We're using, you know, hand cleanser all the time. And so our immune system isn't needing to fight all the infections that it used to fight, and that makes it potentially more likely to become misdirected and attack things that are innocent, like the proteins in foods.
When you talk about the immune, is this an autoimmune condition?
No, although there seems to be an increase in autoimmunity and in allergy. Autoimmune is the body attacking itself.
Okay.
Allergy is the body basically attacking something harmless from outside the body, whether it's an animal, dander, a pollen, or in this case, a food.
What is happening during an allergic reaction? Not everybody has the same sort of reaction to something when it's an allergic reaction.
So there's sometimes confusion between an allergy and other adverse things that happen to us from food. So, for example, you know, I can get jittery from caffeine, but that's a pharmacologic effect. It's just the chemical doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I might get sick from eating rotten food, but, you know, it's food poisoning. And I may have gas and bloating and loose stools from the sugar that's in milk, but that's a lactose intolerance. It's basically a problem with digesting the sugar that's in milk. It's not the immune system. It's not an allergy. With allergy, the most common type of allergy is the immediate allergic reaction. A severe one is often called anaphylaxis. But the kind of symptoms that we see are pretty characteristic for and distinguish an allergic response. So, for example, the skin could be affected with rashes or hives that happen soon after eating the food. The gut could be affected with stomach pain and vomiting or diarrhea later on. The more dangerous aspects are the swelling that can happen in the throat, the trouble breathing like asthma that can happen in the lungs, and the trouble with blood circulation, because the blood vessels can get weak and the heart not beat as strong, and then you could end up with real problems with getting blood around your body and have low blood pressure. Ultimately, the reaction, although and many times it's you know, relatively mild and bothersome because it's just maybe hives, but it can be life-threatening and deadly.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about allergies today. My guest is Dr. Scott Schischerer. He is a pediatric allergist at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City. His book, Food Allergies, A Complete Guide for Eating When Your Life Depends on It, is now out in its second edition. If you have a question or comment about allergies for the doctor, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So this is something that happened to me. I had a scratch test one time, and they said I was very allergic to chocolate. And now I found out that that's really not a thing. Is the scratch test the best way?
So believe it or not, you know, the easiest and best way of trying to figure out if we're dealing with an allergy is getting a story. You know, what brought up the problem of chocolate for you would have been the conversation. So there are different types of tests. There's a scratch test you talked about, which we put a little extract of the food that we're concerned about on the skin, scratch the area and see if it swells up like a little mosquito bite. There's a blood test that measures the immune response is called IgE. It's an antibody that the body makes for an allergic response, and you might have IgE antibodies to the particular food that you're allergic to. Both of those tests, however, are very sensitive in that they pick up, they're very good at picking up the allergic response, but many people have positive tests and are sensitized to the food, But when they eat the food, nothing happens. So, for example, if I go into the park and I just test people for peanut, what is their peanut test? Almost 1 in 10 test positive, but obviously the vast majority of those people are able to eat it anyway. So it's not like a pregnancy test. It's not like a yes or no. We have to start with a careful history. Does, you know, do we have a suspicion that a particular food caused a particular symptom? And if we are suspicious, then, you know, we can interpret the test differently than if, you know, you're just randomly testing. So it's not a good idea to just say, hey, doc, you know, I'm getting headaches. Test me for everything that's in food allergy, because you'd say, well, you know, headaches don't come from food allergies, so why would we do that testing? And if we did it, we'd end up probably with a bunch of positives that are meaningless. On the other hand, if you walk in and say, you know, doc, I had a meal, it had a bunch of different ingredients in it, I swelled up, I couldn't breathe, ended up in the emergency room, then we'd say, okay, well, you know, let's talk about what the ingredients were, let's talk about which ones you do or don't eat frequently, and then we could focus on testing for the ones that are real potential culprits.
What are some of the long-term health consequences of having a food allergy? Are there any, as long as you avoid the food?
Well, you know, the primary way to avoid an allergic reaction is to avoid the food. And so if you're allergic to peanuts and you just don't eat them, then you won't have symptoms from that. There are some types of allergies that are less common than the kind I've been discussing so far, where people will have chronic stomach problems or chronic skin rashes from essentially including that food in their diet on a, you know, regular basis. Those are a little bit more subtle and harder to diagnose, but there are groups of those skin and gut problems that are related to food allergy as well. But for the kind I mentioned before, you know, if you don't eat the food, then you're not showing symptoms.
What can you grow out of a food allergy?
Yeah, the good news, at least for children, is that most of the common food allergies of childhood are outgrown. So the foods that cause most of the problems, so you mentioned chocolate, and that's not one of the common ones, although there are some people with chocolate allergy, but the common ones are milk, egg, wheat, soy, peanuts, tree nuts, fish, and shellfish. And for children, allergies to milk, egg, wheat, and soy are usually outgrown during childhood. Allergies to peanuts, tree nuts, fish, and shellfish, which sometimes also begin first in adulthood, are ones that tend to stick around, and it's possible to outgrow them, but it's much less common to outgrow those.
What about people who have multiple allergies to all kinds of foods? What about them? What's different about them?
So there's something about, you know, their immune system that is leading them to attack multiple foods. We definitely see, actually, is it a large number of people with any food allergy or allergic to more than one food.
Okay.
It's actually sort of unusual to find someone who's only allergic to one single thing, but it happens. You might find someone who's just allergic to peanuts and really nothing else, or just cashews and nothing else. But we often do see things going together where, you know, a child might have an allergy to egg and peanut and maybe some other foods. Once they have a disposition towards allergy, we actually do see some of the more common foods popping up as ones that are problematic. And, you know, that's part of our scenario of testing as well, those skin tests and blood tests I talked to you about. And sometimes we're stuck with someone who, you know, we're not so sure whether they're really allergic or not. And we actually have to do a medically supervised feeding called an oral food challenge of the potential culprit food to find out, you know, if they really can eat it or not, or if they've outgrown it.
Chris in Asheville, you're on the air with Dr. Scott Sicherer. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Ann. Hi, Dr. Fisher. Thanks for taking my call. As you stated, I've always understood that, you know, an allergic reaction is in response to proteins. And I was wondering if a person has a peanut allergy, if they would necessarily be allergic to peanut oil because of residual proteins in the commercially processed oil, or is that a real danger, or is it actually quite mitigated because of the processing?
Sure.
I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks, Chris.
thanks for asking. It's a good question. So peanut oil that's highly processed really doesn't have residual protein. The problem is that extruded peanut oil, which is often used in restaurants and gourmet foods, will have residual protein in it, and sometimes you don't know what you're getting. So I'll usually advise my patients who are significantly peanut allergic to avoid peanut oils because they might get the wrong one, and it's usually easy to find an alternative oil to use. So again, you are correct on target in that the types of peanut oils may have different risk levels.
Maybe you've already answered this, and I apologize, but why are things like peanuts so commonly such common allergens?
I didn't answer it,
okay.
And I wish I could.
Okay.
So that list of foods I mentioned before, you know, milk, egg, wheat, soy, peanut, tree nut, fish, and shellfish, you know, why is it that list, and why is it not, you know, apples and chocolate and other things? And so, you know, we think we know the answer in that the proteins in those foods tend to survive digestion and heating pretty well, and so they probably make it into our bloodstream more easily. There are probably some other aspects of some of the foods, not just the proteins themselves, but some of the other components of the foods that might stimulate the immune response in an allergic manner. So I think, you know, there are differences in some of these foods that cause the bigger problems, and the biggest answer really is that the protein makes it, you know, through your gut and into your bloodstream.
What are some of your tips for avoiding certain foods at restaurants or at school or that kind of a thing? I mean, I grew up when there were no peanut-free zones, and now it's pretty common.
Yeah, well, this is part of the anxiety of living with food allergy. I mean, it's really like living in a minefield. You know, you think about how often each day you eat. I mean, it's multiple meals and snacks, and then it's parties and it's social occasions and it's every holiday and birthday. I mean, there's always food around. So people with food allergies really experience an impact on quality of life because of all, even though they might look perfectly healthy not eating it, they're constantly having to think about how to get food safely. So the story is that if you're buying a packaged product, you really have to read the ingredient label and read it each time because ingredients can change. The laws for labeling improved about a decade ago, mm-hmm. but there are still some nuances there in terms of things that say may contain a facility with. All of those warnings, you know, do have to be heeded by people with significant allergies because you don't know what could be in the food. In terms of restaurant eating, we did studies looking at, you know, what people say in the restaurant. The workers, and you know, many times they feel that, you know, they can provide a safe meal, which is great. But then if you start asking details, it turns out that many times they don't understand about hidden ingredients and cross contact. In other words, you know, if I have a chicken soup with no milk in it, but I stir a cream soup and then take that same ladle and stir the chicken soup, now I've introduced milk into that chicken soup. And you know, someone might say, well, I have a severe milk allergy. Can I get the chicken soup? They're like, well, yeah, there's no milk ingredients, but you know, in the back there, they've caused a problem by cross contact. That you might say, well, gee, you know, does the salad have nuts? And, you know, maybe it doesn't, but if they're chopping the salad and chopping nuts, or if they're picking the nuts off of a salad, that's not going to be good enough for someone with a significant allergy. So there's a lot of discussion and training that's necessary. And of course, you know, we also have to, you know, be prepared in case there's an accidental ingestion and a reaction. So our patients with significant food allergies are carrying around auto-injectors of epinephrine, which is a medicine that reverses severe symptoms and gives you time to get to the emergency room. And they have to, be ready to use that and know what to do in case of an emergency, and also how to have the conversations that they need to have to, you know, get safe foods.
Why is it that some people are allergic to eggs, other people are very allergic to eggs? You made the reference to a significant allergy. So there's a continuum.
There is. It's definitely, you know, our attention goes to the news articles of the child who might have had a trace amount, had a severe reaction. But this really is a spectrum. I mean, there are people who can eat a certain amount of the food until they get to some threshold, and then they start to react. There are people who can eat a food fine, but if they eat the food and then exercise, or eat that food and have aspirin, or eat that food and are menstruating, or eat that food and have alcohol, those additional factors sometimes make the immune system or the absorption of the food different, and you end up with a reaction. So there really, you know, are a spectrum. People with asthma tend to have more severe reactions than people without asthma, just because the lung is more involved for those people. So there are many nuances in terms of how people react. With egg and milk allergy, for example, about 70% of people are able to ingest egg or milk when it is baked into a bakery product. The extensive heating and the airy atmosphere of a muffin or a cookie will break down that protein. But having said that, you know, if you're a listener who, you know, is avoiding milk or egg and have never had those types of products, you'd have to get evaluated by your allergist to find out if that's a possibility for you, because there are people who have severe allergic reactions even to the baked forms of those foods. But yes, there's a lot of variation.
Peggy in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Peggy.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Hello.
Hey, my question has to do with kind of a broader look at allergies, because I hear from some sources that food allergies just don't occur in other places at the rate that they do in places like the U.S., where we have an abundance of food, where there are in food-challenged areas of the world that there are fewer food allergies. I wonder.
You're right. You're right, and this speaks to what I was speaking about earlier. Yeah, it speaks to what I was discussing earlier, which is our lifestyle has probably changed in a way that our immune system hasn't caught up to and has sort of left us in a lurch where we end up with more allergies. So, for example, in countries that are not so industrialized, people are living, you know, in larger families. They may have parasites. They have other infections. Their, you know, lifestyle is just very different. And it may not be the variety of food, but it might be more these other factors. There's a vitamin D hypothesis in addition. You know, vitamin D is something that helps with our immune system. And, you know, we spend a lot more time indoors. We're on the computer or on the phone or whatever inside instead of being outside. Sunlight helps our body to make vitamin D. And there seems to be more allergy further you get from the equator, so that might be part of the story as well. So there are a lot of different theories, but when countries become more industrialized, they see more food allergy. In China, in rural areas, there's very little food allergy, but in the industrialized areas, we're seeing increasing allergies to the same rates that we're seeing in the U.S. or Canada or Australia.
Peggy, thanks a lot for that call. We have an email from a listener who writes, I get the worst migraine headache if I eat anything with MSG, so I have learned to avoid anything I think may contain MSG. I made homemade soup and I thought I would be safe because it was mostly fresh vegetables and a low-sodium broth. Well, I got the headache I only get after eating MSG. I Googled every ingredient on the broth and it contained autolyzed yeast extract. Can your guest speak to this? Should labeling have warned me about this ingredient?
So getting headaches from foods is a little bit of a controversial area, mostly because there's just not a ton of research confirming what the different triggers might be. There is a notion that some of the tyramine types of foods might trigger migraines, so actually things like chocolate. Some people blame MSG. It's again, you know, it's a little controversial. The studies say it doesn't happen, but I say, well, I get it myself, so doesn't that count? But you know, it's not an allergy. It's more, if it's anything, it's an effect of the chemicals of the food. So it's hard for me to answer, you know, how labeling might address that.
Mm-hmm.
But it, in terms of is it a thing or is it not a thing, you know, it seems to probably be a thing.
And also, there's a difference between having a sensitivity. I know I can't eat, like, lettuces and stuff that are preserved. You know, in a lot of restaurants, they use preservatives mm-hmm. for lettuces, and I don't. I'm real careful about where I order a salad from because I get indigestion, but that's not an allergy, is it?
Right. So, you know, there's, as I was saying earlier, there are a lot of things that cause adverse reactions to foods that are not the immune system, not an allergy. And so the headache story that we just had mm-hmm. is one of those things, an upset stomach from, you know, roughage or gas from beans. You know, these are all issues, but they're not the immune response.
And then finally, I mean, are food allergies different in any fundamental way from other allergies, say pollen?
The mechanisms are quite similar. It's just that the protein in the food is getting into your body in a way where it gets to get through the bloodstream and can trigger typically more severe reactions. I mean, someone with asthma might have a terrible response being around, let's say, a cat that they're allergic to, and it could be very significant. But when you're eating a food that you're allergic to, it gets into the bloodstream and can cause problems in multiple areas of the body, kind of like a bee sting might also, or a drug allergy might, where, you know, this protein can spread around and then cause problems in multiple parts, and that's where the life-threatening issue. The good news in all of this is that we finally have a number of potential therapies that are in the pipeline that are being studied in phase three or final trials for approaches to try to treat these allergies, not just staying away from the food. And that's really made this field very exciting. And we also have some amazing findings on how to prevent food allergies, particularly for peanut allergies, based on some studies that were done just in the past couple of years. And recommendations are now changing about how and when to introduce, for example, peanut for children to try to prevent peanut allergy by actually introducing it earlier.
Dr. Sisher, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it, Anne.
Dr. Scott Sisserer, he is a pediatric allergist at Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City, and his book, Food Allergies, A Complete Guide for Eating When Your Life Depends on It, just came out in its second edition. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Concussions have been in the news a lot in recent years, especially due to the focus on the brains of football players and degenerative brain disease. But concussions are not limited to athletes. A 2016 poll from NPR and TruVen Health Analytics found that nearly one in four people report having had a concussion. Researchers have made strides in understanding those risks and long-term effects of concussions, but there is a lot we still don't know. And knowing the science can't really prepare someone for the experience of suffering a concussion and going through the recovery process. Science editor for The Verge, Elizabeth Lopato, recently wrote about her own experience recovering from a brain injury. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I guess it's afternoon there.
Well, no, it's not quite. Not quite. We're getting there.
Perfect.
Yeah. Well, tell us what you remember about what caused your concussion.
So I was bicycling on my way to go to a yoga class, and a car turned left in front of me, and I hit my brakes, and I remember realizing that I didn't have time to stop, and that's the last thing I remember. And the next thing I remember after that is waking up, seeing the sky above me, and two men leaning over me to put a brace around my neck. They were either EMTs or paramedics, and I was about to go to the hospital.
What were the hours right after the accident like for you, and what did you think about?
Well, one of the things that always surprises people when I tell this story is that I didn't particularly feel disturbed or afraid. I wasn't scared, but I was definitely really confused. So there was just a lot happening around me, and I had a hard time staying awake, or maybe I just had a hard time forming new memories because there are a bunch of things that are sort of blank for me. So I don't remember what anybody looked like. I couldn't describe to you the EMTs or many of the nurses who treated me. I only remember bits and pieces of the ER experience. I had been there for several hours and I have maybe half an hour worth of memories.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being very excited because I was about to have a CT scan, and I'm a science reporter. I've written about CT scans. I've never had one before, and I was, like, stoked. And I didn't remember the CT scan at all.
But at the time, it was kind of funny reading your article, and just from talking to you, I can see you have a sense of humor. But you say that you thought you told the CT, the CT technician, that I'm a science writer. And then you thought, wait, am I a science writer?
Yeah, that's right. It was a weird thing where I had access to my memories, but I didn't have any emotions associated with them. So I would say something like, I'm a science writer, and then I'd be like, wait a minute, is that right?
Am I just making stuff up now?
Yeah, exactly.
It was the left side of your head that hurt the most, and you described what that felt like. Tell us.
It really felt like my skull was just trying to escape through my head. It was like, felt like it was knocking against my skin. Now, obviously that doesn't seem physiologically possible, but that was very much the sensation.
Yeah.
Was that like my skull was like, well, I've had enough with this.
Yeah. It's so weird. And you say skull versus brain. That struck me too.
Yeah. I mean, it was the brain is relatively soft. It's pretty gelatinous. It's about the texture of jelly. And this was a much harder pressure than that. So it seemed pretty natural that it would be the bone pressing against my face rather than something that's softer.
You said that they gave you fentanyl, which, of course, is that really, really strong drug that a lot of people are ODing on these days, heroin addicts. It didn't affect the pain, but it affected your reaction to the pain.
That's right. I mean, the pain was still there. The pain stayed for about a week. I just had a constant headache, for a really nasty constant headache, for about a week. But it turns out my reaction to fentanyl, which I did not know before that evening, is that it doesn't necessarily make the pain go away, but it makes me just not care about it very much.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in pain, but it didn't particularly bother me, which is a strange sensation if you've never had it.
Yeah, I never have. So what happens to the brain during a concussion? What is a concussion now?
So a concussion is a mild traumatic brain injury, and it appears on a spectrum of traumatic brain injuries, right? There are the much more serious ones that we sort of associate with, for instance, IEDs, the sort of things one encounters in the military, or car accidents, that kind of thing. And this is very low on that spectrum, right? It's not as serious as those things. There's no real structural damage, but there is something terrible going on inside your skull. Because what has happened is that a bunch of your sort of nerve fibers have essentially twisted. They are, dumping the transmitters they use to communicate with each other sort of willy-nilly into your brain. And I mean, the short version of it is it's just chaos. And so anything that has to coordinate against it through different parts of the brain is affected. And so that's vision, that's balance, and that's sound. Those things, your brain is coordinating several different areas. There are messages that are going from here and there. And, when it's difficult to communicate because, the blood vessels are leaky and the brain cells have stretched or twisted and the chemicals they're using to communicate have been sort of dumped at random. All of that gets really messed up. So that's why you see these common symptoms like difficulty balancing. People's pupils don't react to light the way that they should. They seem really confused. They're maybe not making memories right. There's emotional disturbances. All of that is pretty normal.
And confusion, and that was something that one of the EMTs said to you or said to their colleague at the time when they were asking you questions.
That's right. They were asking me questions, and one of them looked at the other and was like, she's confused.
Meaning,
sure was.
That's a sign that something's wrong.
That's right. It's a clinical symptom.
What do we know now about the connection between concussions and chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE?
Yeah. So we know that repeated concussions raise the risk for CTE. We don't necessarily know what the prevalence of CTE is, and part of that is just because it's so new that it's difficult to get a hold of. In particular, there was that recent study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association that used donated NFL players' brains, where, 99% of the brains had signs of damage, but the caveat to that is that healthy retired players' families probably didn't donate their brains. So you don't really know how common CTE is just based on that study. But the study did find something interesting, which is that the longer somebody had played, the more likely it was that their brain showed signs of this particular kind of damage. So it seems likely that if, one concussion is bad, many concussions are worse.
Can you get a concussion and not know it?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I feel like probably you would notice changes in your consciousness. That is part of the definition of concussion. According to the CDC, it's any kind of bump or jolt that results in a change to your mental state. So if you're experiencing confusion or some kind of change, alteration, then you're probably concussed.
Why is mood affected?
So that has to do with the way that blood works in the brain. Basically, what's going on is there's a place in your brain. It's called the hippocampus. It looks like a seahorse. And it's really very sensitive to blood flow. So if your blood flow is decreased, as it frequently is during a concussion, your hippocampus doesn't work right. And that's important for memory because that's where your short-term memories get encoded. So that's part of the reason why you see these sort of blackouts, because you know, because of the changes that are going on in your brain, the hippocampus isn't working properly.
Are there parts of your head that you can hit that are going to make you more prone to a concussion? Do you know?
I don't think it matters.
Okay.
One of the things that is known is that twisting hits, anything that causes torsion, can be worse than a direct hit. And that's one of the reasons that a lot of sort of helmet makers are looking into different ways of padding helmets and testing out different kinds of ways of protecting the skull, because it turns out that these sort of like twisting hits can occur pretty frequently in the NFL. So there are a lot of folks who are looking into trying to protect the brain from that kind of torsion.
You know, there's also the theory that the better they make the helmets, the harder they hit on the field.
There is. I can't speak to that.
Mm-hmm.
What I do know is that, we haven't thought in a serious way about concussions for most of the history of sports, really. You know, there was a period where it was just getting your bell rung, right? And,
mm-hmm.
like, it wasn't a very big deal, and you were just going to tough it up, and you were going to go back in. And what we've increasingly realized is that, no, this is an actual brain injury. There's no structural damage, but things are going wrong. And these people, need to be taken out of the game so that they don't get a second concussion, which could potentially be deadly. So I think we're really in the infancy of understanding what's going on here, and I expect to see a lot more research done in the next 5 to 10 years that will tell us more than we already know.
They did tell you, or somebody told you at the time you were lucky you had a helmet on, right?
Yeah, I mean, listen, if you ever you ever want positive reinforcement for wearing a bike helmet, getting into an accident is a really good way to do it, because every medical professional you talk to will say it's a good thing you're wearing a helmet because...
It could have been worse.
Exactly.
Yeah. Why recovery times are different for men and women, right? Do we know why?
So recovery times can be different. The whole thing is, it's a little tricky because brains are different and the amount of hit you took is different. But in general, women take a little longer than men to recover. That's not necessarily the case for every woman, but it is generally the case. About 1 in 5 people experience symptoms of concussion for longer than a week. I was one of those people. And so I had difficulty with light and with sound in particular. My balance had pretty much, it was close to normal by the end of a week, I could go downstairs, I could step down a curb, all of the stuff that had been like a little nerve-wracking immediately afterwards had sort of evened out by then. But it took about a month for the sound and light symptoms to go away.
I've always found it fascinating. We think of the brain and you think of getting hit by a car on your bike or getting hit in a pro football game is one thing. But you don't think of something like reading as that brain taxing per se. But when people get concussions, they don't want you to necessarily be reading. Kids in high school, they don't want you to necessarily be going to class or doing your homework.
Right. I mean, that is, your brain is working for that. And I was told not to read. I was told not to watch television, which sort of blew my plans for recovery. So I was like, fine, I'm going to watch Murder, She Wrote.
Exactly.
But they were like, don't do that. And it turns out that both of those things are cognitively complex. They require a fair amount of brain energy. And in fact, watching TV is more difficult than you think it is, particularly if you're having vision problems because of all of the cuts between scenes. Like you have to figure out what's going on. And that is something that can be very taxing immediately after a concussion. So I was told, don't read anything. Keep the TV to a minimum. Don't use the internet. Just chill for a week.
And you've recovered.
I did.
I'm glad. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Elizabeth Lopato is a science editor for The Verge. We'll have a link to her article about recovering from a concussion on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thank you very much for listening today. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.